Welcome to Arizona Boomer Radio with the Boomer and the Babe. Arizona Boomer Radio gives voice to 1.4 million boomers throughout the Grand Canyon State and beyond. Each show has a different guest and a different topic. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now here are the hosts of the show, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And indeed, welcome to another edition on Thursday, August 16th, 2012 of Arizona Boomer Radio with the Boomer and the Babe. We're broadcasting from our studios in Sun City, Arizona, and I'm Pete Peters.
And I'm Deborah Brown.
And we thank you all for listening, and also we'd like to invite you to visit our BoomerandTheBabe.com website, see everything that the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated is involved in, and hopefully if there's anything there that we can help you or your business with, that you look us up and give us an opportunity to talk to you. As I said, I'm Pete Peters, and we have a special guest today. Actually, Deborah could be considered a special guest because she's not been here very frequently.
Well, thank you.
So we're going to go with two special guests. One of them will be Deborah, and she's going to carry this interview pretty much for the balance of the show. And our guest is C.L. Gilmore, and C.L. Gilmore was a special education teacher for 25 years and gave everything to her passion for teaching. She apparently didn't get the memo that retirement is a time for relaxation and reflection on a time well spent in her recently completed career. Instead, she set out to excel in her other passion, writing romance novels and poetry. C.L. Gilmore, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here. Deborah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we're very happy to have you here. And I'm going to ask you to do what I always ask our guests to do, and that is what I call your two-minute movie. And that is your life, as far back as you'd like to go, for 2 minutes, laser beam style, because I know you've got a lot to say, and your two-minute movie, please.
All right. Well, let's see. I was born and raised in and around Muscatine, Iowa, which is a little river town along the Mississippi River. I graduated from Muscatine High School in 1967. I attended Central Missouri State University in Warrensburg and graduated from there in 1974 with a double major in elementary and special education. I've done graduate work at the University of Missouri in Kansas City in the area of learning disabilities. I've done graduate work at Northern Arizona University in educational leadership, and I have early childhood certification, multiple disability certification, and English as a second language certification.
You're making me tired.
I know. I'm tired, too. I'm glad I'm done taking classes. I married Mike Coble in 1971. We have two sons, Adam, who's married to Abigail, and they have three children, Jackson, Maya Lane, and Whitney. And my son Aaron, who's married to Kirsten, and they have two little ones, Emmy Kay and Dylan. So we have five grandchildren. I retired after 25 years of teaching in May of 2010, and I taught special education most of that time in Harrisonville, Missouri, Kansas City, Independence, Missouri, and then finished up my last 15 years at Peoria School District in Peoria, Arizona, working with multiple disability students.
Well, you know, we're laughing because I said you're making me tired, but, you know, in the intro we said that you didn't get the memo that you were supposed to rest after, A, all of that education and certification and so forth, and working for 25 years with those special children who I know you loved and gave so much to, and that's got to be tiring. Weren't you tired at the end of 25 years of that?
You know, some days that last year, it was tiring because the students that I worked with, like I said, were multiple disability students, and these are students, a lot of them are in wheelchairs. They're coming back from catastrophic injuries like near drownings, car accidents, and things like this, and we're teaching them how to talk again, eat again, walk again. So it was very physical, but just probably that last 15 years was the best of my teaching career, working with these special students and getting to know their parents.
Right. I know that was an endearing time. You know, a lot of children that you touched that I know that you have great memories, and actually I've met one of them.
Yes, Eli.
Yes, I met Eli, and I have the great pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, of knowing Cheryl very well, and I will say that we introduced her as C.L. Gilmore. That is your nom de plume.
It is.
And but we will not call you C.L., and I have to tell the listeners
yes,
something funny.
Yes, please tell
them
that
story. I met C.L. at an event and promptly forgot her name. Not her, but I forgot her name. And then we had a lunch meeting, and we were talking about whether or not we would do some work together. And I'm sitting there thinking, I still cannot believe this, but I don't know her first name. And I was thinking, well, surely she's going to give me her business card here, and I'm going to get that name thing handled. Because I didn't want to say, oh, by the way, we've been here for 2 hours at lunch, and I still don't know your name. So she hands me the card, and it says C.L. Gilmore. And I'm like, oh, you're kidding me. I can't believe this. Well, I'll get her email address. And when she gave me the email address, it was not her name either. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. So I don't remember. Maybe you gave me a different email address finally, and I realized, oh, thank God, her name is Cheryl. And finally, I just had to tell her, this is so ridiculous, but you're messing with me because, you know, the CL was just not working. But you know what? You've used a nom de plume. Now, there's a reason for that. I haven't asked you that, but I can. Why did you do that?
C.L. Gilmore is my maiden name, and I wanted to use my maiden name. I like the name Gilmore, and since I am a baby boomer, I figured more people would remember me as Gilmore instead of Coble, and it was just kind of a tribute to my family.
I like that. You know, it's funny because I still have my original name. I've been married a couple times and always went back to Brown. So Pete and I have been together 24 years, and my name is still Brown. And that's not a reflection on him. It's just I like my name.
I know, me too.
I love it. All right, so you finished your first career, and you woke up one day and you said, I've got more to do, clearly.
Pretty much.
So why in the world did you think that writing a novel and a poetry book simultaneously was your next big thing?
I have always written for as long as I can remember. I used to write stories, plays, song lyrics. I came across a poem that I'd written to my mom. I must have been in first grade. I could barely read it. But I just have always enjoyed writing. And when I was teaching in school, if someone needed a letter or a play or something for their students, they would come to me and I would write. So it was kind of a natural progression for me that had been on the back burner, my teaching career. And so when I retired, I decided I can do this. And actually, nobody told me I couldn't do it, so I did it.
Well, that's that baby boomer, you know, quest for the next thing, and nobody says you can't. And even if they did say you can't, you would have done it anyway,
no,
right?
Exactly.
Right. So did you have any special training, or was it really just a function of you'd always enjoyed writing and you thought, I mean, I really don't know the answer to this question as well as I know you. Did you just say, you know what, I know I can do it, or I know you read a lot getting ready for this process.
I did. I just enjoyed writing, and I had been writing poetry, and so I kind of started there, and I started waking up in the middle of the night with stanzas of poems and ideas for poems, and so that's kind of where this all started. And I started writing these poems down, and you know, I had 5, and then I had 10, and then I had 20, and I thought, you know, this is a good thing. My brain is working again, and I want to do something with this. And so I had written a play for my special education students, and we were getting ready to put this play on, and a publicity notice went out to all the magazines and newspapers in the Phoenix area. And Mary Holden, who was one of the editors of Raising Arizona Kids magazine, happened to get this. They were having a morning meeting, and they throw out all the things that are coming, and she says, I scrambled almost across the table to get that because I saw it said medically fragile students play or something. And so Mary came to cover the play that I put on, and that's how we met. And I sent her a follow-up email and said, I'm a writer. I write poetry, and I was wondering if you would be interested in reading any of my poetry. And that's kind of how it got started. And we had a meeting and sat down at, I don't remember where it was, Paradise Bakery or Starbucks or someplace like that. And she read my poetry, and she said, "Have you ever thought about writing anything else?" And I said, "Well, I write articles, I write short stories." And she says, "Have you ever thought about writing a novel?" And I said, "No, I read a lot of novels." And at that time, I had just been this voracious reader, and I was probably up to about 275 novels by then. Excuse me. And by the time I finished, I had read about 350 romance novels that ran the gamut from, very mild to very erotic. I was just testing the waters and reading everything I could get. And so when she asked me if I had considered writing a novel, I thought, no, but why not? I can write. I should be able to write a novel. So that's kind of how that happened.
What's interesting about the story with Mary Holden is that I have also met Mary Holden out in the world at a networking event. And I have met, through Mary, some of the most wonderful people, you among them, and someone that you and I both know, and that's Jerry Simmons,
right,
who is an amazing man, also came as a result of Mary Holden's wide network of wonderful people. So I feel like I'm one of her people, too.
Exactly. We're all kind of under her umbrella now.
Yeah. It's like, okay, the Mary Holden Club.
Exactly.
But, she's amazing. And Jerry Simmons, of course, is the person that was the Random House and
Time Warner
mm-hmm. vice president of sales for books like Bridges of Madison County, the Rich Dad, Poor Dad series, and all those. So when we say, we've got some people that have helped, forge some of this great trail for us, Jerry's one of them.
Exactly. Jerry's the one that really, if you would have asked me an education question, there was no doubt about it, I could have answered it. But when it came to writing and publishing, I knew absolutely nothing about any of this other than that I could write. And so he helped me on every aspect, Mary edited, but he helped me like on cover design and ISBN numbers and things that I just didn't have any idea about.
Right. He's got, I forget what his website is called. I think it's
Indie Publishing.
Indie Publishing, yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's amazing, and his website is wonderful. So just look up Jerry D, like dog, Jerry D. Simmons, and you'll find out more about Jerry. All right, so your book then includes the poetry, which is really unusual. In that all of the chapters start with that. So we'll come back to that because I know that that is something that you're going to keep doing, and I want to hear why. But you wrote Uncommon Bond. That is the book that is the first novel that you've written.
Yes.
And the main characters are Rose and Jake. And I want to know, did you wake up one day and say, you know what, I think I'm going to write about Rose and Jake? I mean, I've read 300 romance novels and whatever. So what'd you do? How'd that work?
Actually, I did kind of wake up one morning or went to bed one night thinking about it. I'm not quite sure. It's been a while. Thinking about these two characters. And I had read so many romance novels, and they do kind of follow a pattern. There's a flawed female, and there's usually a young man who comes to her rescue and they ride off into the sunset, basically. I had this in my head, and then I had listened to coworkers and friends talk about this first love phenomenon that happens not with everyone, but with a large majority. Both men and women have this unforgettable first love, and sometimes you marry that first love, sometimes circumstances happen and you don't marry them, but they stay in your head and they stay in your heart. And I thought, this is a great premise for a romance novel. And then I thought, and in this day and age, I need to move this into something that's relative to now. And I automatically thought about Facebook and texting. And so that's that's kind of the format for Uncommon Bond, is the fact that Rose and Jake reunite, reacquaint, rekindle, whatever the word is, on Facebook after not seeing each other, not hearing from each other for over 40 years.
Wow. And I, of course, I've read the book, and I know that there are some parts of it that I like very much. And matter of fact, it's probably, I don't know if you called it the prologue or the introduction or whatever, but it sets up why this happened for Rose. So why don't you do us the honor, it's an honor for me to hear you read. I have to tell the listeners, I've allowed Cheryl to read to me many times. I enjoy it, so please read for us.
The biggest change for me was living in an empty nest. I found myself at a fork in the road and at a place where I could decide on a new direction. That I was even aware of this choice is amazing in and of itself. I think many women just continue down the path of least resistance, the path that is familiar. It doesn't seem to matter that the path has become so familiar that all the surroundings have lost their color, their smell, their flavor, their appeal. Society tells us that this is how it should be as one settles into the final phase of life, especially for women. Just when we need a boost, a change, some color, we are told that this is normal and this is how things should look. Except for the garden on my patio, I had been walking down this colorless path for a very long time. I wondered how many thousands and thousands of women were walking the same path. Women just like me who never made their own plans and became part of someone else's dreams. They accept this without realizing they have a choice for something different. Or maybe they don't want the choice, choosing instead the familiar. But I know there is a choice, and the choice is a personal decision. Change is difficult, scary, and the older one gets, the harder it is to even see a need for change, let alone make the change. It may be impossible for some to choose another path simply because of the way they're made inside. One has to have felt that difference a long time ago, somewhere along the line, even though it might have been buried in the day-to-day existence. One has to have been that person long ago who asked, why don't I fit into this family? Why can't I think like they do? Why am I able to go places in my mind when others can't? These are the people who give up good jobs to pursue what they like to do instead. These are the people who leave everything familiar behind and move across the country, the world, to places unknown in search of a new direction, a new path, to see color once again. These are the people who look at their marriages of 30 or 40 years and decide for happiness instead of routine familiarity. I think these kinds of people are like the explorers and the pioneers. They are wired differently. I knew early on I was wired differently. Sometimes fate or providence or divine intervention or just plain luck happens, and events are set in motion that defy time and explanation. I got an opportunity to step out and reach out to something and someone who became the trigger for my remembrance of something more, something that was left behind a long time ago. Without a real plan for what could happen, I made an effort and reached out for a chance meeting with someone who gave me a glimpse of the color again, if only for an instant. But in that instant, I saw it, I remembered it, and I wanted it. Someone stepped back through time and into my life again, and everything routine, mundane, and colorless changed. This someone knew about my plans, my hopes, my dreams. This someone knew the person I had been when I started out. This someone knew me, and because of that, I could clearly see a different path that I wanted to walk down, a path that was filled with the colors of life once again. He had been my friend, my soul friend, a kindred spirit. He had been my lover 40 years ago. His name is Jake Richardson.
All righty. So that sets us up for a lot of good stuff in there. And I'll tell you, I was making some notes of some of the things that I know about people. And that is, you know, when you're 59 years old, I just turned 59 today.
Happy
you
birthday.
Know that. Thank you. And, you know, I'm not in the final phase, right? We're not
we're
in the
not.
Final phase.
We're
so not
are,
in
yeah,
the final
exactly
phase.
That's exactly right.
And it's like, are you kidding me? I'm 59. I'm not 89 or 209. It's amazing. So, yeah, I can see how a boost would be a good thing. I'm not necessarily going to go, you know, follow your book's path, but I'm, you know, I'm aware of it, and I can see why people would. And I love the fact that you talk about the colors. And I can imagine Rose seeing things in either black and white or, you know, like a muddy kind of just all one hue kind of thing. And then getting excited again and having something to look forward to. Is that what happened to her?
Yes. And, you know, and part of this, I'm a great observer. I've always kind of hovered around the outskirts of things and watched. I'm a great watcher. And part of this came, this color thing came, one night my husband and I were out to dinner, and I was watching this couple, you know, two or three tables away from us, and they were they're probably a little bit older than we were. I can't remember at this point. But I would glance at them every once in a while, and there was no conversation. They weren't talking. And they sat through an entire meal, you know, must have been like 45 minutes to an hour, and I don't think I ever saw them even talk to one another. And I thought, how does this happen, and why does it happen, and why let it happen? And so that was when I came back and I was writing, I thought about that, and I thought about the woman, and I thought about the man. Sometimes we just think about the woman, but it happens in both sexes, is that you get so entrenched in the routine, the daily routine of things, that you forget there's more out there.
Exactly. Now, I know that there was some research going on before you sent this over to Mary for final edit, and I know that, you know, how you chose the names and some of the research about lots of things that were happening, because this is set in today, but it also is relating back 40 years, right?
Right, late 60s.
So you wanted to make sure that it wasn't just your memories, but also
my memories and other people's memories.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I'm saying, like, you know, song titles and, you know,
even names.
Oh.
Did, you know, every name in the book, every character in the book, if it was from that, you know, say, I don't know, 1947 to, you know, early 50s birth date, I would research names. So I would have an appropriate name for my character.
So it might not be Tiffany or something like that, if Tiffany was not a common or
exactly.
even somewhat
exactly.
recognized name then.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And again, some of them were from my memories. Rose, I remember this girl. I have no idea where she is now or anything, but I remember her, and she was that one of those girls who just looked beautiful all the time. And she didn't have blonde hair. Rose has blonde hair in the story, but this gal had long kind of darker hair. But I remember her in a two-piece bathing suit, and she always looked perfect. And I thought, okay, I remember Rose, so I think I will use that name. So that's how Rose got her name.
I love that story.
Friend of mine.
I love that story. There's a person that's probably going to show up in a novel that I'm going to write, and I may not use her name, but it will be her that I am thinking of
exactly.
when I write her.
Exactly. You have to have someone in your mind.
Yeah, and her name is Mindy in real life, and she's tall, absolutely stunning. Very athletic, all the things that I am not. I mean, I'm
exactly.
You know, I'm not tall.
Me either.
I'm not athletic.
No.
She was blonde. I'm a brunette. But there was something about Mindy and her name. My name is Deborah. I mean, it's like as common as, you know, a $1 bill. There's like a billion of us. And matter of fact, I know how many of us there are. It's not a billion, but it's millions.
There was a billion Cheryls in my
well, exactly. So anyway,
day too.
So Mindy had the cool name, and she was tall and lanky and wonderful, but she also had an appendix that burst, so she had her own issues. But my point is, you do kind of put it together that way, don't you? You find people back in your past
you do.
And, and some things that make the story work.
Right, and that's how you mold these characters too. They're really never one person. You know, they're like Jake's several people, and so is Rose, and they're stories and things that you've heard from friends and acquaintances along the way and little tidbits that you remember, and they all fold in to make a character.
But you create an avatar about that person, right? I mean, you can see them in your mind's eye.
Yes.
And then you know characteristics about them, and you know that there are certain things they would not say and they would not do on a bet.
Right. And you even after a while, when you worked with these characters for so long, you can even hear their voices in your to any writer and you'll know
have
voices in your head.
I have another question. Do you also imagine who would play them in a movie?
I do. I do. I have played this scenario. Jake has always reminded me of Jeff Bridges.
Love Jeff Bridges.
I know. Or Chris, what is I'm trying to think of his name. I thought about it. Oh, I'll come back to it. His first name's Chris, and I can't think of it now. But yeah, Jeff Bridges would be my first choice.
So a little scuffed up, a little,
yeah,
little ruggedy.
Kind of, you know, not drop-dead gorgeous handsome. Just,
so
you know,
not Richard Gere.
No, not Richard Gere,
yeah,
for
I,
sure.
See, I've
no.
read the book, so
Chris
I know.
Chris Cooper.
Ah, okay.
Chris Cooper.
Yes. Oh,
yeah.
I love him.
Yes. See, he almost... when I think of Jake, I think of Chris Cooper's face and kind of Jeff Bridges' mannerisms. So, see, there's a combination right there of characters.
Now, do you think that you and I are the only people that have read Uncommon Bond that sit around and figure out who would play? Because I know that.
No,
people
I have readers who clue me in and say, you know, don't you think that this would be that she would make a good Rose? And I'll say, yeah, she really would. I've had Susan Sarandon suggested, and Sissy Spacek, and Meryl Streep.
Yeah, I'm thinking Meryl Streep could be, except that she's just been in a movie right now that she just seems older to me than she did before I saw the previews for that. It's like, now we have to young her up a little bit.
I haven't.
Because I don't think Rose is that...
I haven't seen that movie yet,
I
saw Uncomplicated with her in it,
uh-huh.
And I love that.
Well,
so.
She's phenomenal. Yeah, she would be a perfect Rose, actually. So you figure out, like you say, okay, now do you also, this is kind of selfish of me, because I do want to write romance novels, so I'm sort of picking your brain a little bit, and I'm saying, okay, this is something I want to do, and I don't want to do it wrong.
I don't know that there is a right or wrong way.
Ah.
You just need to do it. There's so many people that talk about writing, and the difference between writing and not writing is writing. It's actually getting on the keyboard and typing things out and doing it. You just that was Mary and Jerry's advice to me. Write. What should I do? Write.
Well, I know that you also wrote like a bat out of hell and then realized that you were done at some point because Mary said, you've got to be done. You know, you can't keep going.
I was so naive. We went away for the weekend to Tucson to work on the book, and she was working on an editing project. And she came up behind me when I was working, and she said, have you single-spaced all of this? And I said, yes. And she says, well, you really should double space. She says, how many words do you have? And I said, 83,000. And she says, well, a good novel is about 90,000. She says, where are you? And I said, oh, I'm so glad you said that because I was running out of a storyline.
That is so funny. I love that story. I absolutely love that story. And then you can take some of what you realized that you needed to say and put it in the sequel.
Exactly.
Right? Things that they didn't finish. Things that...
Oh, there's a big unfinished scene in the first
okay.
one.
Oh, okay. See, I don't know. It's not out yet. But how do you keep track of, like the sequence, literally, the sequence, so that you don't say, oh, that wouldn't have happened in there.
Now, this is something that you do learn, and you kind of learn it the hard way. When we were editing the first book, Mary and I did have some wrong sequential things, timeline. So a timeline for a novel is really important, that you have to keep your date straight. And it's doubly important when you're writing a sequel because you know, some people aren't really critical, but then there are those people out there, kind of like me and probably like you,
oh, yeah.
who really go back and they look, you know, they look to make sure the names match up, the dates match up. And so
I absolutely do that.
I have a timeline, you know, that I work from that I make sure that I plug the right people in and the right sequence in so it follows.
Cool.
And if I put song lyrics in or a song title, then... And I say that it happened in, you know, May of 1969. Then that song should have been out then. So you Google that and make sure it is.
Well, I know that that people watch Mad Men on Sunday nights whenever that's out, and they watch to make sure that the things that
exactly.
they got on there are appropriate, and they do look it up. You know,
well,
like
and baby
if somebody's
boomers,
wearing pantyhose,
we know
exactly. If somebody's wearing pantyhose at the wrong time in history or something like that,
they'll hear
like,
about
it. Wait a minute, that's not right. That's
right.
wrong. And you watch what's on TV, and you go, well, that couldn't be then. You know, it's all related to when Kennedy was shot.
That's
that didn't
exactly
happen
right.
And I do. I catalog all of that. So it's kind of a thing. Now sequels are kind of tricky.
You know, they are tricky, and this sequel has taken me a lot longer to write than the first book. Of course, I have a lot of the other things going on that I didn't have going on with the first book either. But the thing with the sequel is that it has to be able to stand on its own for those who didn't read the first book. And it also has to not be so repetitive that it's boring for the people who did read the first book.
Right.
So it's kind of a fine dance that you have going with a sequel like this. And so I'm tying loose ends together and trying out different endings and different scenarios in the book. And, I'll have one ending and I'll think, I don't know how that will play. And so I'll read it to Mary or someone and they'll say, I don't know about that. And so so this sequel has taken longer.
I understand that. So... It's interesting that your poetry and your prose are interconnected so beautifully, and that's not, let's put the word normal in quotation marks, that's not how people write novels. I mean, they just don't all start with a great poem.
No.
I'm talking about all chapters.
Right, right. And, you know, I thought about, well, like I said, I probably in the last 2 years before I started writing, probably read about 350 romance novels, and then over the years you could probably add maybe another couple hundred to that. But I've never come across an author who uses poetry or who writes poetry and also writes novels. So that's kind of a uniqueness with me.
Now, you had said that you wrote 10 or 20 poems before you wrote Uncommon Bond. And, of course, that poetry is in Of Roots, Shoes, and Rhymes, which is an award-winning, thank you very
it
much.
It is, thank you very much.
That's an award-winning poetry book, which is so fantastic for that to be your first published book of poems. And then you also received a finalist award, and this is, of course, from the Indie Excellence Awards. Congratulations on that. That is
thank
huge.
You. Again, it was one of those things of I just did it. I didn't think about it. I just started writing. So
I love
that would be my advice, right.
Exactly. I get that, and I know that's right. And you write every day, or, you know, and if you don't write, you probably feel like you didn't brush your teeth, that kind of feeling.
I pretty much do. I write something every day. I don't always work on the novel. I usually have, right now I'm getting ready for a big high school reunion, and so I've been working on stories that relate to that and poems that relate to that. But when I come back from that, then I will crawl into my cave and we will finish this novel.
Okay, so I started to ask a question and I got off track by commenting and complimenting your awards. But what you did, you had the poems ready to go into the chapters for Uncommon Bond. But for the sequel, you're going
I'm writing
fresh
new.
Material.
I am.
So, and will you publish a book of poems the same way you published? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I probably will. It depends on how many poems I have by the time I'm finished with the sequel. Sometimes a chapter will dictate something that I've already written. I'll think of a verse or something that applies to that chapter, and so I've already have something. But again, I might be in uncharted territory where I need something fresh, and so I'll write, you know, an entirely new stanza and maybe not a completed poem and then go back and complete it after.
Well, as you know, I am not a poet, but I did write a poem recently.
You did, and I loved it.
Thank you. And I had such a sense of satisfaction, and I was scared to death to send it to you. I honestly was, and I didn't tell you that, but I'm telling you now, because I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if it's good or not. I think it is. And I should have just known, really, that it was. And I have sent it to some other people who were equally complimentary as you have been.
It was beautiful.
Thank you. And so I guess my point is, I know how I constructed that. I know where I got my inspiration. Where does the inspiration come from? Is it to fit the book, or does it come from somewhere else and then it just all magically appears in the right order?
You know, poems come to me in thoughts, or they I'll see something and I'll smell something, and poem, a line will come, or a stanza will come, and I'll jot it down. I keep a pencil and notebook by my bed. I have one of those tape recorders that you click and record ideas, and they mostly come to me in solitary moments when I'm out walking the dogs, or if I'm on my bicycle or something, and I'll get a thought in my head, and then I have to keep repeating it till I get home and I can write that thought down. But they just kind of, and sometimes poems, I get the ideas and they'll just flow, and I can just sit down and write them out. And then other poems, I will get everything done but one stanza, and I will work for 2 or 3 weeks on four lines, and someone would think, oh my gosh, but it just, you know, you're looking for just the right words, just the right way to say something, and so sometimes it takes longer.
Well, I know that one of the poems that I do want you to read for us is called The Dance. And I want you to tell me a little bit about how you came up with some of the words and some of the construct of it. And then I will have you read it, because it is one of the best ones. It's not my very favorite, though.
I know your favorite one.
All right.
By the way, that's been made into a song. I forgot to tell you
that.
Oh,
my goodness. All righty.
Well, The Dance kind of came out of, I was thinking about relationships and where they go and what happens in a relationship, and I was comparing it to a dance, and so that was the thought that was in my head when I started writing this. And this poem started out just like so many of my poems. I get an idea, in this case it was the dance, and so I pull up terms that have to do with the subject. In this case, it was the dance. So I pulled up words and terms: waltz, framed, rehearsed, turn, nod, well-practiced, timing, dancer, positions, beat. And I write all those down so that they're visible to me as I'm thinking, as I'm coming up with lines. And I work these words in, so that's the theme. That's the theme. And then I try to come up with a cadence to the poem that will fit the words. And in this case, it came up 3-4 times. I just kept hearing, as I was thinking of the words and the lines, I kept hearing the waltz meter in my head. So I'll read you The Dance. The Dance. A tentative waltz, sway, rise, and fall, forward, side, back, a reflective recall. Letters and words now carefully framed, each thought rehearsed again and again. No turn or nod is left up to chance. Steps have become a well-practiced dance. Cues and timing both cautiously guarded, the familiar rhythm lost and discarded. Each dancer wary of crossing that line, a closed position of mutual resign. How far the distance traveled in a beat? A tentative waltz left incomplete.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
That is beautiful. And I would like to say also that it reminds me of your video book trailer.
It does.
And yep. your video book trailer, and I really do want everyone to go and make sure that they see that on your website, which is?
www.clgilmore.com.
And that, how many L's in Gilmore?
Two.
There you go. clgilmore.com. And the video book trailer, I was actually there for one of the nights of the filming, and you did this as if it were a major production.
It's like a little mini movie.
It is the most beautiful book trailer probably out there, and if there was a way to get an award for that, you should have. Matter of fact, there probably is. We should probably figure out
probably
how do we do that. But it is the dance, and you made sure that the hands were in the right place, and the people were standing the right way, and the light was the right way,
and the clothing was vintage. And
yeah,
exactly.
So it's a very it's not complicated. It's just
detail.
Detail. Mm-hmm. Exactly the word. Right. So, is there anything about Rose and Jake that we should know other than how do they get back together, or you know, do you want to tell people?
Oh, I can't tell.
Not
you
in the sequel.
That.
Not in the sequel. But how did they? You just want people to have to go to your website and buy the book.
I think that's
all right,
the best
cool.
way.
Cool. Well, all right. We're not going to tell. I'm fine with that. I love the book. Okay. So what have you learned, though, really, about writing and self-publishing and marketing that could help others in their quest?
I think the main thing, and this is probably with any profession, is that you just have to have that desire and you have to have that drive to write, to want to do this project. And you have to stop thinking about it and actually start doing it and sitting down and making yourself, you know, write. And that might sound really easy, but you do get in these slumps where you absolutely think that you're brain dead and nothing's coming, but you sometimes you need a change of atmosphere. Sometimes when I get in a slump, I go to Paradise Bakery and I call it my office back in the corner, and there's something about that background noise at Paradise Bakery that always gets me gets my creative juices flowing again. So that's one of the things that I do. I think another thing is that you have to realize that what you write is not going to appeal to everyone. And that's hard because you're going to get good reviews and you're going to get really bad reviews, and I've gotten them all. And, you know, when that first bad review comes in, you're crushed and you question your worth as a writer. And I remember calling Mary Holden late one night and telling her about this review, and she says, you know, John Grisham gets bad reviews. And that was really all she had to say, and I get it. I mean, I'm not comparing myself with John Grisham, but you have to realize that not everybody's going to get what you're writing, or not everyone's going to like it, and that's just the way it is.
Well, I want to make sure that we pick up, you know, in your thought process, you know, in the rest of what you will tell us about what you've learned, but I want to add something about there are some students of Jack Canfield, of course, very prolific writer,
exactly.
And of course The Chicken Soup for the Soul is one of the most loved series in the world, probably. And people who are devotees of him and his teachings and trainings and all that stuff will certainly hear him say, just write, you know, start writing. But there's one woman that was on a workshop that I was listening to, a teleseminar, that waited 11 years to finally write her book because she was afraid that somebody might not like it.
Well, she can count
and
on
guess
it.
Guess what? People love her book, and there may be one or two or 10 or 1,000 people that don't, but she has made such a difference in thousands and thousands of lives. Her book is called Who's Your Gladys?
Huh.
I'm sorry I can't remember her name. Forgive me, I just can't. But Who's Your Gladys? And she finally just said, you know what, I don't care, I guess, you know, if anybody likes it. I need to write it, and that is the rarely, that's it. That's the magic of the whole thing. It's like, you know what, I'm taking it on faith.
Yep, and you do get that feeling that you have so much inside of you that it has to come out.
Right.
You have to write.
Exactly.
You can't not write.
So what else do you have to do, and what else have you learned that other people should know so they don't have to figure it out later?
Promoting your book. I remember that was one of the things that Jerry Simmons kept drilling into my head. He said, you know, there are probably thousands of really excellent books that are written every day and published. but because they don't know how to market or they don't know how to get the book out there, no one ever reads them. And that's exactly true. I was going to say that the writing part of the book is the easiest part. I'm not sure that I would say that. It kind of is. But the marketing is a 24/7 job.
Well,
and you're continually trying to get yourself, your book, and out there in front of people.
Here's the other thing that most people don't realize, and that is the marketing of the book starts the day you think you're going to start writing it.
Right.
So, and I don't know that you knew that.
No, I didn't know that.
So given that, you spent X number of months in the writing process that was the same time frame that you could have been promoting the book.
But didn't know that.
That's right. And there's another person that I love, his whole theory on this, is John Locke. And that's L-O-C-K-E. And anybody that wants to find out about how to, frankly, make a lot of money publishing books and writing books, John Locke. He's the first person to sell 1 million e-books, and he did it in 5 months.
Wow.
It's outrageous. And it's because he created a community of people waiting for his next book. And so, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we learn, right? You've got to create your community.
Exactly.
And that's why, yes, you will have bad reviews, but those people have read your book, right? Or they're just nasty people who just enjoy doing that, which there's a group of those people out there too. But probably the idea of building that community and having that tribe of people waiting for the sequel,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I know you're doing a very good job, you know, in getting people to understand, although we haven't mentioned the name of the sequel, which we must do. What is it?
A Friend Request.
A Friend Request.
Right.
Absolutely. So, all right, so we've got the promotion, and how about the editor? Do you think you should write a book and just edit it yourself? Or?
You know, I've had quite a few responses on my website of people asking, you know, they have poems or they've written a book and what should be their next step. And the first thing I tell them is you need to find a really good editor. And I always recommend Mary. Editing, there's more to editing than correcting grammar and throwing in a comma and, you know, capitalization and things like that. An editor sees your writing and knows you and your style of writing and enhances it instead of trying to change it. And
Mary knows Rose and Jake, too.
Right, right. She's
Mary,
very familiar with these characters. And
so if you tried to have them do something or say something that is out of sync,
she would
she's
going
to say, really?
She would pick up on that immediately.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so I know that you've got these two awards. We've talked about the fact that you won first place for the poems, the poetry book, and you got the finalist position for the Uncommon Bond, the novel. How about that as a process? I mean, it's got to make you very proud, of course.
It is. It's exciting. And that's another thing that you learn as you go along is that there are contests and there are opportunities out there to, you know, put your books in and this again gives you, you know, more publicity and get your name out there, and this is a really good thing, and it's part of that 24/7 PR that you have to continually be working on, getting yourself and your name and your website and your books out there.
Now, how about social media and technology? I mean, are you counting on that as part of your? I know you've got a website, and I know you've got a Facebook page, and you know, is that part of your?
Well, today that's huge. The social media and, you know, the net, computer savvy things. You really can't market any product, let alone, you know, writing or a book, without using the internet. And especially since my book's tied, you know, to Facebook, it's crucial for me.
Now, see, I tried to get you to tell us that a minute ago, I tried to get you to drop.
Oh, I get it now.
Yeah, I tried to get you to drop that, and I thought, okay, she doesn't want to go there. Yeah, it's got a Facebook component.
It does.
And
Jake and Rose meet on Facebook. She's actually she's trying to find a best friend of hers, and she hasn't been able to, Rose hasn't been able to locate her, and so she's remembering all these people from her past, and Jake, you know, floats into her memory, and she realizes that Jake has been this person that she really has kept suppressed for 40 years.
Ah.
But anyway, she happens to bring him up in a search, and there's several Jake Richardsons, and she picks one that she thinks might be in an area where he still is, and sends him a friend request and a message, and asks, you know, are you the Jake Richardson who used to live at so and so? And lo and behold, he was.
Well, you've got to believe that there are thousands and thousands of people our age who are looking online and going, should I do that or not? You know, I just like to know where my friends are. I don't even remember some of their names. I sure don't remember their last names. You know, I mean, I'm sure that you get notices, not notices, but comments in your Facebook and so forth about how this has mirrored real life, don't you think?
I've tucked all these away and made notes on them. I never use people's names, but I keep notes on everything. And I think what surprised me, and I don't know why it did, but it did, was I get just as many messages and emails from men as I get from women, you know, who will say things like, you know, you read my mind. You know, how did you know about the colors? Or I can't, you know, I've been married for 40 years, but I can't forget this person. You know, how did you know that? Well, I know it because I listen and I read, and it's pretty common. And people are reacquainting more and more with Facebook and texting and these dating services and things like this. It's well, part of today.
Yeah,
part
boomers
of now.
Boomers have a new one called Our Time.
I saw that.
OurTime.com. I haven't been on it, but we had the Love Doctor,
mm-hmm.
whose name is Teresa. Sorry, can't remember that either. Boy, I'm having at 59.
Having a boomer moment.
Yes, my boomer moments are coming to me today. But yeah, the Love Doctor is someone that's been on our show and has written an article for our publication called Experience Speaks. And Boomer Experience Speaks, rather, our magazine. And you know, she was talking about, because she writes for OurTime.com,
mm.
and revisiting the idea of the love relationship at this age.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, you talk about that first love experience and the fact that Rose and Jake had that, you know, that beginning. There's almost a chemistry and something chemical about that whole thing that comes up for people, don't you think?
You know, I do. You know, you can have dated a lot of people, you know, back in the day, but for a lot of people, there's just that one person that stays in your memory, stays in your heart, and that you made some sort of a connection with. And I don't have any research on this or anything, but I think it is kind of a chemical thing. It's you know, when you're young and you're first exploring and you're first dating, and there's just a special connection that's made. And I have read this and you know, the responses that I've got back from the book, and I know of a couple of instances where this has worked out. I mean, a husband or a wife has died, and they've gotten divorced, and they've reconnected with this first love, and they've gotten together, and it's, you know, been wonderful.
Right.
I also know where it hasn't worked out.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, we've talked about this before, but when you're talking about the senses and how, you know, some of the things that can remind you of that first love. Now, there's one guy, I don't know, junior, senior year in high school. he was not my first love, but if you say his name or if I say his name and then think about him at all, it's as if he were in the room and I could smell his cologne, like right now.
Exactly.
Robin,
yep.
Robin. I say the word Robin, and I've got that smell, that cologne, in my face. You know, it's,
yep.
it's the most amazing
and
thing.
And that is, to me, that is kind of a chemical thing. I mean,
I know.
Your brain has, they talk about brain connections all the time. I mean, we talked about that in special ed for, you know, 25 years.
Sure. I also want to talk about the fact that your poetry book was a collaboration with an absolutely phenomenal artist for your cover design. She's an amazing painter. I want you to tell us about that because I just want people to understand the difference between how you've done this and how most people or many people do this. This is a multi-layered project.
It is.
This is, this is top drawer, the best-looking covers, the best-looking paper, you know, the best writing it can be, the best editing, you know what I'm saying, and the movie that you did for the video book trailer, it's all top drawer. And I want you to talk about the covers and the inside of the poetry book, which is Of Roots, Shoes, and Rhymes.
Catherine Henneman, who was a friend of my editor's, Mary's, again, Mary Holden, is an artist, an abstract artist, who is a native Arizonan. She was born in Prescott, Arizona, and she had her first show in Westwood, California, and she has had art shows in Florence and Rome, Italy, Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Palm Springs, all over. And anyway, she and I just connected, and, you know, I just love her. She's just a dear friend now. But one day we were just over there talking, and I said, you know, I need to get a cover. I need to get cover art for my poetry book, and I'm thinking about having this someone do some illustrations. And so we were just racking our brains. She says, "You know what? I think I could paint something that had to do with that." And so Catherine, bless her heart, she did two original paintings that became the cover of the book and the interior pictures of the book. We took pieces of her paintings, and so on each page where there's a poem, there is also artwork. So it's not only do you get beautiful poems, but you get beautiful artwork as well.
It is stunning.
We are working on another project called Poetry and Paintings, and we're going to do a 2013 calendar and note cards that have poetry and painting.
Awesome. Now, I know you've already said that A Friend Request is the next big hurrah.
It is.
And when is it going to be released? How do we get you know, on a list to be notified when it's ready?
Okay, I am hoping to get it out by December or January at the latest. And it will be on my website. It'll be available at www.clgilmore.com, and also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, where the two books are available in paperback on Amazon, and the novel is available in ebook format also from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So that's where that one will be also.
And you also have the spoken word.
I do. I have a... And that's another thing. If you order from my website, you can get both books, and then I have a CD of the poetry that I've read that you get for free, basically, if you order both books.
I love that. So should we end on one more poem, and then you made me happy. You're reading for me on my birthday. That's what
I know. You have a favorite poem. And I have, John Mahoney has a recording studio in Glendale, Arizona, and he did my audio book of Roots, Shoes, and Rhymes, and he also took the poem adopted by Roy Rogers and set it to music. So I will have that on my website soon.
Fantastic.
Okay, so this is my happy birthday to Deborah Brown, and
you.
The poem is called Adopted by Roy Rogers. I remember as a child lying in bed at night, covers over my head, listening to them fight. and I always wondered when I heard my name if I was the cause or if I was to blame. Had I played too loud and made them mad, forgotten my chores and made them sad? I had to do something, that was for sure. I needed to be adopted by Roy Rogers, praying he'd hurry and find me each night, hiding under my covers till the time was right. Then off into the sunset we would both ride, adopted by Roy Rogers, partners side by side. I always knew that Roy adopted kids like me. He only wanted special ones for his family. I'd have to like horses and ride in the range. Could I wear chaps, or would I look strange? Was my head too small for a 10-gallon hat? And if I wore boots, would I fall down flat? I had to do something, that was for sure. I needed to be adopted by Roy Rogers, praying he'd hurry and find me each night, hiding under my covers till the time was right. Then off into the sunset we would both ride, adopted by Roy Rogers, partners side by side. I didn't ever give up, even though he never came, and hiding under blankets became a nightly game. My westward imagination helped tune out all the fights, and pretending Roy was on his way got me through those nights. I had to do something, that was for sure. I needed to be adopted by Roy Rogers, praying he'd hurry and find me each night, hiding under my covers till the time was right. Then off into the sunset we would both ride, adopted by Roy Rogers, partners side by side. Happy birthday.
Okay, well, that's a problem. Now, see, I wasn't going to cry.
She cries at all my poems.
I cannot believe I did that. Sorry, let me clear my throat. Wow. You know what? I was fine. I was perfectly fine until you got to the end. So thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Thank you so much. Well, I am very proud of you. I love your work. I hope people will go to your website and check it out and buy your book and, by gosh, keep you in paper and pen and
computer and ink and whatever.
Ink and all that good stuff. And I just wish you great blessings because it's a lot of work, but it's wonderful that you do it for us because it's the baby boomers that are going to enjoy this, really.
Exactly.
It is. So
it is.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you for being here with us today and for sharing your great work. So this is my friend, author, and poet, C.L. Gilmore, my friend Cheryl. Thank God I know her name.
That is a good thing.
So, Pete, take us out.
Well, everybody's been listening to the Boomer and the Babe on Arizona Boomer Radio for our second show this afternoon with the guest C.L. Gilmore. And I'd like to thank C.L. Gilmore for being here with us today. And with that, we're going to say be sure and join us tomorrow. We have an excellent guest tomorrow as well at our 10 o'clock program. And so the gentleman is a futurist, and we're going to be learning about the future and what's in store for us. So that should be a great show as well. So everybody have a great afternoon and a wonderful evening, and we'll see you again tomorrow on Arizona Boomer Radio. Thanks for listening, everybody.
You've been listening to Arizona Boomer Radio with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Arizona Boomer Radio is produced by the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated and can be heard Monday through Friday. You can sign up for their online magazine at boomerandthebabe.com. To reach the Boomer and the Babe, email host@boomerandthebabe.com or friend them on facebook.com/boomerandbabe. And on Blog Talk, you can friend them at blogtalkradio.com/boomerandbabe. Follow their tweets at twitter.com/boomerandbabe. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. And remember, at 50, you're just getting started.